From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Ronald Romney McDaniel is the new chair of Michigan's GOP.
She really did try and reach out to the grassroots, to what some people might call the Tea Party, and to sort of pledge to bring them into the fold more.
Now, what's ahead for Michigan's Republicans? Plus, do cops need college? How having a college degree impacts the way an officer works?
Those that are educated and those that have more experience are able to police more effectively, i.e. with less force.
And we meet a Michigan chef who's used his appearance on Top Chef to help turn the state into a true food destination.
What I see in Michigan is we have the resources, we have the land, we have the fresh water, we have the seasons. I mean, it's a chef's playground. It really is.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. How does having a college degree impact the way a police officer works?
Those that are educated and those that have more experience are able to police more effectively, i.e. with less force.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, do cops need college? Then we explore the greater role Michigan's museums could play in their communities. That's on The Next Idea. But first, Michigan's Republicans held their winter convention this weekend. Ronna Romney McDaniel was chosen as the new Michigan GOP chair after former chair Bobby Shostak decided not to go for another term. MLive's Capitol reporter Jonathan Osting sat down with McDaniel to hear her plans, and he's with us now. Jonathan, that name Romney tells us this is someone with a strong political pedigree.
Yeah, absolutely. Her uncle, of course, is Mitt Romney, former presidential candidate and a Michigan native. And her mother is also named Ronna Romney, who was a Republican National Committee woman here in Michigan. And, of course, she's related to former Governor George Romney.
His granddaughter. So there we have it. But what does she bring to the party beyond that famous name?
Well, the famous name actually does help, of course, because she's got fundraising chops. I think that was a big selling point for her with establishment Republicans, is the fact that she's got that Rolodex. She has those names and numbers of other people who she's going to be able to reach out to fund elections moving forward. Beyond that, as a candidate, she really did try and reach out to the grassroots, to what some people might call the Tea Party, and to sort of pledge to bring them into the fold more. There's obviously been this divide in Michigan and nationally amongst Republicans between so-called establishment and the grassroots, and she's really at least positioned herself publicly as somebody who's going to try and bring those two camps together.
And I know she said to you that was a top priority of hers. Are there signs that she has enough support to build those bridges between the establishment GOP and the Tea Party Republicans?
Well, all three of the candidates said they were going to be the one to be able to do that. So the question is how they follow through. I mean, her basic game plan, as she's described it, is to host more town hall meetings, to really invite local delegates to interact with the party more. There's a feeling by some grassroots activists that the party sort of had these conventions once in a while, but other than that, never really interacted them in any meaningful way with activists who are out there actually pounding pavement and knocking doors in election seasons and stuff like that. So her plan seems, you know, fairly modest but obvious, which is to simply have more events where these people are actually invited to be part of that process. Now, whether that satisfies them, whether that satiates their desire to be part of the party establishment, as it were, remains to be seen.
Overall, Jonathan, what would you say the overall tone of the convention was? I was, you know, wary, conciliatory, contentious?
You know, it was I think less explosive than it could have been. There was a lot of drama heading into the convention. Of course, there's the outstanding question of Dave Ajima. There was potential that the party would take a formal position on Proposal 1, the May 5 roads proposal. None of that stuff actually came to fruition. Some of the real drama of the convention actually happened Friday night, where the state committee was elected. And these are, you know, people who are going to have to work with the new chair, Ron Romney, moving forward. And there was some shakeup there. You might say more grassroots candidates or Tea Party candidates knocked off a few of those establishment people. So the dynamics of the party seem to shift slightly, but not in such a large volume that there was a radical makeover or anything of that nature.
Well, if the Dave Ajima question and the Prop 1 question didn't come up during the convention, what about when you talked with Ronna Romney afterward? What's her view about Prop 1?
Well, Prop 1, she is personally opposed to it. She campaigned on that, saying she didn't like the idea of raising the sales tax to fix the roads. However, when talking to reporters after she was elected, she, you know, acknowledged she knows that a lot of Michigan voters do want to fix the roads. She wants to fix the roads. She said she had to replace her tires and get her car realigned this year. So she understands the need. She seemed to suggest that the party shouldn't necessarily take a formal position on it, simply let the voters decide. Of course, if the party did take a formal position on it, that would be, one might say, an insult to Governor Rick Snyder, who helped spearhead this and put it on the ballot. He is, you know, sort of the figurehead of the Michigan Republican Party. So it would have been an interesting development had the party basically bucked the governor on that issue.
And then the question, how do you solve a problem like Dave Ajima? Did the topic of the troublesome National Committee man come up? You said not in the convention, but what about in her comments when you spoke with her?
Yeah, she was pretty matter-of-fact about it. She said, in her opinion, there is no mechanism for the party to remove Dave Ajima. That's actually been sort of a hot topic within inter-party circles, whether or not they could change rules to allow the party to remove Ajima. But she basically said that the party rules currently don't allow for it. He said he doesn't want to step down, so we're going to just have to move on. She said she's had private conversations with him, but she wants to keep those conversations private. So for the time being, it seems like the status quo will continue. Dave Ajima will remain the Republican National Committeeman from Michigan, despite, you know, her predecessor and a number of other top Republicans saying he should step down.
And what does the new Michigan GOP chair say about the big challenge for Michigan's Republicans, which is to try to, you know, swing Michigan over to the GOP presidential candidate in 2016, something we haven't seen since Bush 41?
Yeah, that's right, 1988. You know, she acknowledges it's going to be an uphill battle. The GOP here in Michigan does really well in midterms, but hasn't been able to get over the hump in a presidential election. In fact, her uncle, Mitt Romney, lost by almost 10 points in 2012. So she knows it's going to be difficult. She said the first order of business is sort of dealing with those internal party politics, getting all of the activists and delegates sort of on the same page so that they can unite and work together for 2016. It's a big question. There's also an open debate about Michigan's primary, when it will be held. The legislature approved legislation last week setting a March 8 primary. But there is talk among some that the new Central Committee might want to move to a closed caucus or a convention, which you know, would no longer allow anyone in the state to vote in the primary. It would be more of a closed process involving only Republicans. And the goal from both parties on either side of that debate is trying to at least get some of those candidates here in Michigan talking about Michigan issues, which could, you know, help raise their prominence moving into a general election.
MLive's Capital reporter Jonathan Osting. As always, thanks so much, Jonathan.
Hey, thank you.
Thursday, people in Kalamazoo get your chance to speak out about a compromise plan for an old industrial landfill that is stuffed with 1.5 million cubic yards of toxic waste. Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith is here. Lindsay, what's in this landfill? Where'd it come from?
It came from paper mill factories a long time ago, over the past really 100 years. Kalamazoo Valley was once where a ton of paper was manufactured. And this actually came from kind of an interesting story that, you know, the carbonless copy paper we used to have a ton of?
Yes.
That's actually where the contamination came from. They would recycle that paper, and they used to put some kind of chemical in there, a PCB, that got recycled, and then they basically just dumped their waste into the river back then before the Clean Water Act. So that's where it came from.
So here's this festering landfill with the wood pulp and this waste and toxic chemicals in there. And this proposed plan to deal with it isn't exactly what city officials wanted, is it?
No, it's not. They definitely wanted it to be completely removed. But the companies that once ran these paper mills are bankrupt, and there's not a huge chunk of change to take care of the problem, about $50 million in a trust. And total removal was estimated anywhere between, you know, $160 and $300 million, so much more than they have available.
So what does the plan do?
This kind of brings a compromise into play where the city recognizes that there's not that pot of money available. It would consolidate the bulk of the, you know, 1.5 million cubic yard contamination into like a larger hill, and then it would cap it on top. The idea is that because it's mixed with clay, it's not really traveled anywhere. It's not considered very risky to travel anywhere into the water, etc. So the idea is that it'll stay there, and then at least around that neighborhood, which is right smack dab in the middle of the city, you would be able to redevelop some areas. We're not talking about major shops, I don't think. More like parks, trails, that kind of a thing.
How did people react to this plan when it was first floated?
This is really the first bite of the apple the public will get. The plan was first floated back in December, right around the holidays, so I don't know if people really paid attention to it that much. We'll see what people will say on Thursday, what their gut reaction is to it.
Well, you can fill us in then after that happens. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith, as always, good to talk with you, Lindsay.
Yeah, great to be here.
When we learned about the 80-year-old American agave plant that was preparing to bloom and then die. That 27-foot plant had been at the Matai Botanical Garden at the University of Michigan since 1934. Well, now comes word the agave has finished its once-in-a-lifetime flowering process, and it only has about a month to live. It'll be chopped down sometime next month. It certainly fulfilled its mission. Horticulturists report that this plant produced tons of seeds, which can be used to grow another American agave. Still to come, we catch up with the executive chef of The Root in White Lake Township.
What I see in Michigan is we have the resources, we have the land, we have the fresh water, we have the seasons. I mean, it's a chef's playground. It really is.
A conversation with Chef James Rigotto. And then, long before Detroit factories were known for cars, they were churning out stoves. More on that story in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In just a few short years, executive chef James Rigotto of The Root in Oakland County's White Lake has made huge waves in Michigan's culinary scene. In 2012, during its very first year of business, The Root won the prestigious Restaurant of the Year Award from the Detroit Free Press. Since then, Chef Rigotto has continued to earn recognition for his work, competing on the Food Network show's Top Chef and also winning local accolades. He also runs the popular Young Guns dinner series, which features top chefs from Michigan and all around the country. Chef James Rigotto, it is so good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
You have been quoted as saying the best thing about Top Chef was the chance to plug into and build the network of chefs. Can you tell us how that's going and what it's doing?
Yeah, that was by far the real victory of being on Top Chef was the network of the chefs. So to me, you're not going to have a chance to sit down with 15 other chefs from across the nation for 5 weeks. And this was really the opportunity to kind of like take a, it was almost a barometer of where the national food scene is. So I stayed in touch with these chefs, you know, after the show. And really, even while we were on the show, I was brokering kind of the next event. You know, Rebecca and I were talking about Young Guns 5, which took place in October up in Traverse City.
Rebecca being?
Rebecca LaMalfa from Trencherman in Chicago. And she's the executive sous chef at Trencherman. And she's amazing resume. She's married to a 2-Michelin-star chef that runs 16 in the Trump Tower. So she's just food all the time. Mm. So now you have Rebecca looks at Detroit as this, like, you know, basically a go-to zone, place to make money, a place to cook food, a place to be a chef because she's a sous chef. So she gets to kind of stand on her own here in Michigan. Where in Chicago, maybe she's like, I don't want to say, you know, under any thumbs or anything, but she doesn't have quite the crazy freedom that she does on a blank canvas.
So she's got this blank canvas and she can bring all of her colors and paint away.
Yeah.
And the idea that Detroit is a good, fertile place for this to happen. And
absolutely.
Michigan.
Michigan to me is, I see the, you know, I travel a lot. So, you know, we just went to a 9-day trip all over France, like literally from Brittany down to Marseille. You know, and I go to California on the regular, Chicago, obviously, many times a year.
Yes.
I'm all over the place. But what I see in Michigan is we have the resources, we have the land, we have the fresh water, we have the seasons. I mean, it's a chef's playground. It really is. You know, thimbleberries and ramps and, you know, fresh peas and fiddleheads and every wild game you can imagine and, you know, the lake fish. And it's just, I am constantly inspired by the farmers and the growers and the butchers and the brewers. You know, we have 182 microbreweries. It's just amazing. Wine country. You know, some of the best sparkling wine is made from, you know, Larry Mauby. Virtue cider. It's just, it's endless. So our beverage game, our seasonal game, our food game, really, I mean, the only thing that's missing is the body of chefs. We have these up-and-comers. We have, you know, a lot of the veterans, but we don't have enough chefs filling in the blanks, in my opinion. And, you know, we have a lot of great guys that are cooking and girls that are cooking aggressively, but we don't quite have that pedigree that you see in Chicago. You know, we don't. And
I'm curious.
Why
do you think? Yeah, because when you think about what Detroit has and what Chicago has, they're really pretty darn similar. I mean, they're, you know, location and kind of the history. I mean, what do you think?
That's a good question. And I think that, you know, it's almost rhetoric. You know, I don't have an exact answer, but one thing that I noticed when I was on the show is I probably had the worst resume on the whole show because, you know, who am I going to work for? I mean, I love Luciano Del Signore and Brian Polson. These guys are awesome, but are they, you know, are they national big name? Are they Jean George? Are they, you know, Charlie Trotter? You know, no. I mean, maybe they're just as good, but they just don't have the exposure. Maybe they're not as good. That's the debate. That's the rhetoric.
Yeah.
But what we don't have is, you know, the huge body of we don't have the audience that's just supporting innovation. We don't have, you know, the foodies, I suppose, is the loose term that are just floating these chefs and their innovation.
Is that because Michigan has kind of real blue-collar roots, do you think?
I mean, I think the blue-collar roots are great. I think that allows our food to be, you know, humble and adventurous, you know, but always, you know, evolving. But I think that, like, if you take too many chances, you know, in a restaurant, you kind of get punished by low traffic. So a lot of the chefs, even the innovative chefs, and I'm just as guilty. You gotta have your burger. You gotta have your kind of comfort food. And I think it's okay to have comfortable elements, but we're not being necessarily encouraged for pushing too many boundaries.
That sounds like a challenge to the dining public.
There you go. Of course it is. I mean, I can tell you, you know, I also don't want to go to a restaurant and have a young chef taking too many chances that it sacrifices my experience. So that's where Chicago and New York, you know, because I mean, okay, you go to Grant Atkins' restaurant, you go to Alinea or go to Next, and you spend hundreds of dollars for an experience. But Grant Atkins he's a wonderful classical cook. You know, this guy was cooking at French Laundry in, you know, in the mid-90s. So he has the classics down, and then he pushed himself to be innovative. So I think a lot of our young chefs kind of need to have that checks and balance as well. Learn the classics, do the basics phenomenal, and then be innovative. So it's a call out to the public as well as to the chefs themselves. So reward the adventurous eater. Reward the risk taker. Don't punish them just because you're trying to figure out your culinary style.
when you look at the recovery that Michigan is making from sort of the lost decade, the Great Recession, is it the right time now to plant the seeds for people to start restaurants like you've had the success with The Root? Is this the time?
This is absolutely the time. And I think, you know, the two shining examples, in my opinion, are Rock City Eatery and Hamtramck, mm-hmm. which Nikita opened up, on a shoestring budget. I mean, built the place himself with his dad. And you have Selden Standard, which is, you know, Andy Holiday's restaurant with Evan Hansen. And that's the opposite, you know, as far as the business-wise. I mean, I think they spent $1 million and, you know, on a pretty much a shut-down corner of 2nd and Selden, and just opened up what is now, I mean, not even arguably, it is literally the best restaurant in Detroit.
That's the one you hear everybody talking about.
I've eaten there 5 times. So I've been open 3 months. And it would be 7 or 8 if I didn't work so much. And I love it. We took all the top chefs there, actually, when they were in town for Young Guns, and that was by far the best restaurant experience. I mean, you know, the conversation at the table was, this is better than anything we have in L.A.
I'm talking with Chef James Regatta, who's executive chef at The Root in Oakland County's White Lake Township and a big booster of the food scene in Michigan and in Detroit, and getting more top-drawer chefs to come here and realize what can be done. Looking into the future, what about the chefs of the future? If you're a kid who likes to get into the kitchen and start messing around and creating, what are the do's and don'ts of following a career path like yours?
That's a great one. So I'm a little taboo. So basically my advice when I talk to high schoolers is don't go to college. Wait. Find out what you want to do. You know, touch things. See, if you think you want to be a chef, go spend a month in a kitchen for free. Just shadow me. I'll take a shadow. You know, someone that wants to just follow me around every day and just watch. I've done that many times, and I'd say 1 out of 10 sticks around. 9 out of 10 are like, oh my God.
I never knew what a kitchen
was
like.
Yeah, and they run for the hills. So before going to culinary school, spend time in a kitchen. If you love it and you're good at it and you feel it and you breathe it, then absolutely go to college. Go to the best college you can afford. Go to Schoolcraft, which is, I think, is one of the best colleges in the state. That's when you go to school.
How old were you when you realized that you were drawn to food and to making something of it?
So I mean, my first job was my 14th birthday in a diner. And I mean, I would get in trouble because I would apply at the local market when I was like 13 and just lie. But you know, they knew, I mean, I don't know if they fact checked or they just probably knew my mom because it was a small town. So I mean, I always wanted to work in food. And I say when I was about 15, I started flipping pizzas. At 16, I got a job in a real restaurant. And the first time I saw a line, like a hot line, like mm-hmm. cooks and chef coats and a chef and, you know, fire in the pan and just the ticket machine, I mean, I never came back. So I'd say 16 was like when I jumped, I became a full vampire and just never went back to being a normal human.
When you look at Michigan, what areas do you think have the greatest promise of becoming great food destinations?
I mean, Detroit, hands down. But I think Grand Rapids, Traverse City, and Detroit, to me, that's like the triangle. I think of the triangle. And there's great stops in between, you know. I think that you look at, I mean, obviously Ann Arbor, you know, it has a lot of, you know, a lot of cool things going on. You got a lot of potential to get even better. But I think Grand Rapids, for the beer that they're doing, and then some of the restaurants like Reserve and Grove and what Brewery Vivant is doing with their food program. I mean, they're the only, you know, brewery in the state, in my opinion, that has a food program that even closely reflects the beer program. I get frustrated when I go to some of these places, like, you know, you get some of the best breweries in the world are in Michigan, and then you go and they're serving you nachos and, like, you know, like, I don't know, like falafel. I'm like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with nachos or falafel, but my God, here's one of the most beautifully crafted beers on the planet. Shouldn't it have some of those beautifully crafted food? So I would love to see the breweries elevate their game, you know, with their food.
Yeah.
And I think places like Grand Rapids are definitely ahead of the curve. I mean, Traverse City, you know, you look at Trattoria Stella. I mean, that alone. I mean, that restaurant is one of the best restaurants in the world. And I mean, I've eaten at seven or eight three Michelin star restaurants, you know, and that's, they just, I mean, end of story. That's Stella's, Chef Miles is just, I mean, he's the patron saint of food. I mean, he's amazing.
What's ahead for you? You've made a success of The Root. What do you see as your next mountain to climb?
That's actually a great question. I've kind of like, I just turned 30, a lot of changes in my life. And this is the first time where, I mean, I almost have too many options. So I'm staying focused. I'm taking a crazy road trip in April. I'm basically leaving for a month, and I'm just driving to Portland, down to San Diego and back. And I'm going on a vision quest to kind of find what is the next step. But ultimately, what I'm doing now is not going to stop. I want Detroit to become nationally relevant. And it is right now. I guess I want everyone to understand that. And I want chefs like Mei Lin to open a restaurant here. Because, you know, she's basically deciding what's her next move. And I'm telling her, you need to open a restaurant in Michigan. You know, I want people like Rebecca LaMalfa to like, set up a monthly dinner program here. Come out every month. Like, keep Detroit exciting. You know, keep it moving forward.
Fascinating. Chef James Regatto, executive chef of The Root in White Lake Township. Great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Did you know Detroit was the stove capital before it was the Motor City? Writer Bill Loomis has been digging into the history of what he calls America's first mass-marketed, had-to-have durable good, stoves. And he found just why 19th century Detroit was known as the stove capital of the world. His story first appeared in the Detroit News. So, Bill, long before Detroit factories were known for cars, they were turning out stoves?
That's right. It was a big product for Detroit.
And it was a man named Jeremiah Dwyer, you said, was kind of the epicenter of all this. Tell us a little more about how he fell in love with the idea of making stoves.
Yeah, well, his father was Irish, and he came over to Detroit in the about 1830s or 40s. And Jeremiah, he would walk by on his way to school, Barclay's Iron Works. It was a foundry. And he would watch them ladle in molten iron into these molds. It sort of captivated him. He became almost obsessed with it. He would go over every night and watch it and watch the heat. He wrote kind of poetically about it later in life, how much he loved watching the heat rising up into the stars and all this kind of thing.
It hooked him at a young
age. It hooked him, yeah. He decided at that point he would be an iron man. He spent his whole life in the iron foundry business making these stoves.
But these factories, were they making stoves at the time,
no.
Or what were they making in Detroit?
Right. They really began in the 1840s when they discovered iron ore up in the peninsula, and then in the 1850s when they opened up the Sioux Locks. Then they could ship the ore down. That's when Michigan really took off with the iron work. But initially they were in the 1840s, let's say, they were making parts for steamships. They were making parts for locomotives, farm implements, things like that. Not stoves. The stove business was in New York. That was considered the place because they had better casting sand. Who knows?
So Jeremiah went off to New York and learned the trade.
That's right. He did. He apprenticed in New York. He worked for three different stove manufacturers over there and came back and opened his own in 1861.
And yeah. Before that, people were using to cook and heat their homes. Were this basically the fireplace?
That's right, hearth. And even in tenements, they used hearths. It wasn't a known thing until really after or during the Civil War. They burned wood in the hearth and cooked everything on iron pots and cranes and all that kind of stuff. The problem was not just that there wasn't many things you could cook other than stew-type things, mm-hmm. but it was very inefficient. All the wood it required, everything went up the chimney, or cooked the cook, as they said. So it was a big problem in Detroit. As more and more immigrants came, they cleared more land, so they had to go farther out for wood. If you didn't own your own property, it was expensive. They would go to Canada or the way up north to get wood.
So that was costly.
Yeah.
So getting the stove in and getting the technology to the point where it can heat your house made
right.
a big difference in the amount of wood they needed to use?
Yeah, absolutely. It used much less wood. Also, soon it burned coal, which was more efficient as well. I think in the 1820s, they were burning close to 200,000 cords of wood. They would go through tremendous amounts of wood to work a hearth. And it had to go all the time. You know, with a stove, you could turn it on and off, that kind of stuff.
Well, how did the stove business get from New York to Detroit? Was it Jeremiah
yeah,
and his brother?
It really was Jeremiah and James, and they started working it. And then it got capitalized. By the 1870s, Detroit was really a place to go for stoves. And they also worked very well. People loved, especially families, loved the stove designs. They started out, the stoves were in big public places. They were blocky boxes of iron and not very beautiful. But they were used at hospitals as sort of gigantic space heaters. And it wasn't until they perfected the casting and the molds and things like that, then they could get into these designs that were pretty exotic.
So you could express yourself just the way we want to do it when we're choosing a car or something else. You could really find something that suited you.
Oh, yeah. Just like cars, that's a good point. They changed the design all the time. Every year they would change the design. And so it was the latest and greatest. And a lot of them, they got very good at doing what I would call micro markets. If you read the business papers of the companies, they would have a design for the Franco-Prussian War or in honor of Bismarck for a market in Milwaukee. So they got really good at doing that sort of thing.
At its peak, how many companies were turning out stoves in Detroit?
Well, at its peak, there were about 12, but really four big ones. They made up about 10% or more of the entire U.S. production of stoves. So it was a significant amount. They produced upward of 500,000 stoves a year.
We get into the 20th century, and how did things begin to wane for stoves?
Well, the stoves continued, but people lost interest. They didn't do the cast iron stoves. The cast iron stoves were artisan. They were done by hand, and mass production from the auto companies really kind of took away their glamour, I guess you'd call it. They were automating, and people didn't want cast iron stoves anymore. They wanted enameled steel stoves. Eventually, they were outproduced by other companies and merged with a company in New York. But they still had good years. I mean, they were continuing to make stoves up until the 30s, 40s, and even up in the 50s.
Is there any remnant of those original 12 companies in Detroit still maybe making stoves for now?
Not that I could find. Mm. There's still the Garland brand, which was made by Michigan Stove Company, is still used, but in commercial ovens and stuff like that.
Now, legions of us who grew up driving by the Michigan State Fairgrounds remember that, at Woodward, south of 8 Mile, the huge, huge stove.
Right, right.
Sadly, no longer with us because it was hit by lightning. I remember that in 2011, and it burned to the ground.
Yeah.
How did that all fit in, that giant stove?
Well, that stove was originally made for the Chicago World's Fair, the Columbia World's Fair, in the 1890s. It was a piece that was stunning. It was carved out of wood. The stove companies had wood carvers from Germany and Switzerland and elsewhere who were expert at carving wood, and they had them make this gargantuan stove. It was a replica, and it was painted to look like a stove, and it stood at the World's Fair. And then it came back when the World's Fair was over. It stood on the property of Michigan Stove Company right on Jefferson. And then I think they moved it to Belle Isle, the entrance. I don't know if maybe listeners remember the stove at Belle Isle. And then it ended up, it was at Fort Wayne for repairs for a while, and then it ended up at the State Fair where it met its untimely death.
Okay, so it did. That was pretty sad.
It was sad.
Well, it was an interesting thing to think about and to realize how Detroit was the stove capital before it was the Motor City. And you can find Bill's piece on the Detroit News website. Always good to talk with you and get our look at Michigan history. Bill Loomis, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Still to come, we'll hear about the effects of higher education on policing. And on the next idea, we learn how museums can play a greater role in Michigan's recovery. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
What is more welcoming to visitors of all ages than a hands-on science museum? Instead of peeking at exhibits behind glass or behind velvet ropes, visitors are encouraged to touch, to play, to experience. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea believes museums can play a huge role in getting more young people revved up about science and technology, and that is a key to Michigan's future. Tom Dietz is the project director of Innovation 5. It's a new project at Impression 5 Science Center in Lansing. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Give us a sense what truly excites you about museums.
I'm thrilled to watch young people get excited themselves. It's just the energy that you get when you bring a child into that environment and you begin to see them interact with scientific concepts and just spend an hour in front of an exhibit, just working it over and over again, because you've hit something very deep in them, something that they didn't know they loved, and now they say, yes, I do love this.
You can see the light bulbs going
on.
Yeah,
that's right. It's fabulous.
What roles do you think museums can play in communities?
Well, I think they're very important, and the hands-on science museum movement itself is a relatively new one. It's been growing over the years. I think we're all familiar with Ann Arbor's Hands-on Science Museum across the United States. There are many great ones, the Exploratorium being one of the most well-known. I don't think most people realize that it's now a worldwide movement, and that museums I've visited in places like Chile and Australia have really excellent hands-on science museums that are modeled on what we've been doing in the United States for the last 20 to 30 years.
And we're also seeing traditional museums incorporate hands-on things. I'm thinking of a recent visit with our grandkids to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. Mm. And there was a whole area that had all kinds of interactive stuff that probably had not been there 25 years ago, if not even more recently.
Absolutely. And I think it's a recognition across virtually the entire museum mm-hmm. community that it active learning, where it's where visitors are responsible for their own learning, is a key to engaging them and really educating and into entertaining them, frankly.
But in your essay for The Next Idea, you point to a clear trend that you say folks in the museum business are acutely aware of, and that's the fact that parents will bring the kids when they're little, and then when you talk to them, they go, well, yeah, well, we went when they were little, but you see the kids kind of drop off after 10 or 11 years old. Why do you think that is?
I wish I knew the answer. I'm hoping to find maybe an alternative. That's sort of the goal of this project, to try and keep them engaged as they age a bit. And I think it's partly that if we can get a child to spend 15 or 20 minutes at an exhibit in a hands-on science museum, we consider that a really great success. But we need to get to the next level. If you're 13, 14, 15, 20 minutes in front of an exhibit, that's not the kind of engagement that you're ready for. You need deeper, more long-lasting, sustainable engagement. And we want to build that as we go forward.
And that's the idea behind the Innovation 5 project that you're directing now at Lansing's Impression 5 Science Center. And it is something you hope will hook those kids and keep them coming back and through the years as teenagers and adults. You're incorporating a maker space into mm-hmm. the museum. Can you explain to us what a maker space is?
Sure. I think one simple way of looking at it is it's the neighborhood garage where everybody can go and use the tools. But instead of somebody's garage down the street, it's a facility in a community. And those facilities are frequently very community-oriented. They can be for-profit, they can be non-profit, they can be associated with a different institution. But the goal is to be able to allow people to come into a space where tools are available, a variety of tools from the basics of a sewing machine or a saw up to a 3D printer or a laser cutter. And training, access, and safety issues are taken care of. You can come in and learn and use these tools to do anything you want, whatever strikes your fancy.
What kind of technology do you plan to have at Innovation 5?
Oh, we're going to have a pretty complete set here. One of the things people don't realize is most hands-on science museums are already maker spaces in the sense that we have an exhibit shop, and we build exhibits all the time in there. We're testing and prototyping, which is what a maker space is for. So we have the basics already. We're going to move that into a more 21st century technology. We'll add computer-aided design. We'll add laser printers. We'll add 3D printers, which are a huge technology that kids just and adults, once they realize what you can do with it, they just are fascinated by it, and we think that that's going to be a major draw. We already have gotten a grant we have four 3D printers coming in shortly to start beginning that part of the process.
And I wondered about funding and, mm-hmm. and the expense of putting something like this together for a museum.
Yeah, well, Impression 5 has been very successful in recent years at really reinventing ourselves, and we have just completed a major expansion of the building using private funding, particularly from the Dart Foundation. And this project, we have gotten very positive feedback from a number of groups, and we're in, let's call it, productive discussions with funders. Although we're still looking for mm-hmm. a little more money along the way. This will be involve quite a bit of square footage. We're actually going to build a new entrance that will be for the makerspace so that people from the community don't necessarily have to come into the museum to be a part of the makerspace.
But being part of the makerspace makes them a part of the museum.
Right. And kids who come into the museum will see and be a part of the makerspace from the museum side. Now, they won't be able to go in and start running the laser printers and the laser cutters and all those kinds of things. They will be coming in to do age-appropriate programming. But they will see and, we hope, interact with the projects that are going on in the community side. And that, we hope, will excite them to become more engaged.
What kind of things would people be doing? Because,
I talked to my brother about this, who happens to be a surfer. And he said, I've always wanted to build a new way to attach the skeg to the bottom of a surfboard so you could get it out and put a new one in quickly without using tools, because that would be very convenient for surfers. But I need to build a prototype. And so, one conversation, one brother, that's all I've got.
Yeah.
He's got an idea. He wants to get in our space and build this thing.
And for teens, let's say, who come in and get the training so they know how to do it safely, what kinds of things are you thinking for those young folks?
Oh, you can there's some very easy examples. Are there many, many robotics competitions going on now? Mm. Science Olympiad, which is a very big thing in Michigan, and this involves a lot of building projects. It'd be great to get kids to engage in our facility to build for their school team a trebuchet or whatever tool they need to compete. And that would give them the ability to really take those projects to the next level.
And in your essay for the next idea, you talk about the potential for something like this for other museums in Michigan. And I get the sense you feel this could be sustaining, that this could be as key as the gift shop is to a museum, bottom line.
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. There are a number of places, that, including Ann Arbor, where there are for-profit makerspaces. So these spaces can be not only self-sustaining, but they can actually generate revenue. If you look at this from a business point of view, if I were to discuss this project with a business person, and I said, if you had a store and I could promise that I would give you 100,000 visitors walking by your door, all of whom are interested in your product every year, would you think you could build a business on that? Yes, you could build a business on that.
And looking to the future, what would you hope could happen from these kids who get engaged at an early age and then have a place to come and play and explore and grow as teenagers? And then when they're going into their choices of careers?
One of the things, I work in workforce development as well, and one of the things we hear from manufacturers and companies all over the state and all over the nation is, our kids don't have the hands. We don't have that hands-on background. In my own experience in laboratories, I know the kids who come in who have had a chance to manipulate things and change them and build and adjust, compared to the kids who come in and take a piece of scientific equipment and trash it because they just don't have the background. So we want to give them that background, whether they're going to academia and an advanced degree, or whether they want to do what I think is a very important trend these days, the two-year degree in a technical field to get a decent job in our advanced manufacturing industries in the state.
Certainly something we're hearing from our governor.
That's right.
What's your timeline? When do you hope to have Innovation 5 up and running?
Well, we'd love to have it very soon. We're, I'm hoping probably, you know, you're going to put me on the spot here,
yeah.
Probably in the first of next year, we should have something meaningful going. We're in good negotiations right now, as I say. We do need funding, but we've had such good feedback. We're pretty confident at this point.
Tom Dietz directs the Innovation 5 project coming to Impressions 5 Science Center in Lansing. You can find his essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And then go ahead, share your thoughts and your ideas on how museums can become more engaged in their communities. Just go to the comments section under Tom's essay, or go to Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or as always, on Twitter, at Next Idea MI. Tom Dietz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Do cops need college? How does having a college degree affect an officer's view of police work, the community, commanding officers? Bill Terrell is a Michigan State University criminologist, and he's co-author of a new study on police attitudes. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Your research is really credited with starting to give us a much better view of the effects of higher education on policing. So you surveyed more than 2,100 officers in 7 mid to large size departments across the U.S. What percentage of those officers had college degrees?
45% of them had college degree.
Even though none of the departments required a 4-year degree?
That's correct.
That's not unusual, is it? I believe Detroit Police Department, you can get into the academy out of high school. So the college degree is generally not a needed ticket to the job.
Only 1% of the departments across the U.S. require a 4-year degree. So a large majority of the agencies, all you need is a high school education for entry-level position.
I'm curious, Bill, with the officers, that 45% that did have degrees, what kind of degrees are we talking about?
Half of them had a criminal justice degree, and the other 50% were social science type of degrees as psychology, sociology.
As you heard their views, what emerged? What kind of views and traits did you notice that the college-educated officers tended to have?
Those that had college-level education, particularly the 4-year degree, they tended to have less favorable views towards the jobs, job satisfaction, as well as less favorable attitudes towards their supervisors, particularly top-level managers.
One might look at that and wonder, gee, maybe it's not such a good thing for them to have a college degree, but you say there's really more to it than this?
There is more to it. In this particular study, we looked at the officers in terms of their attitudes, but prior research that I've done, we also found that when you look at behavior, that particularly those officers that get a four-year degree, are significantly less likely to rely on use of force to resolve conflict. So that's a very important finding from a police professionalization standpoint. If we have college education officers and they're able to resolve conflict with less force, that certainly is a beneficial finding.
Certainly in these days of headlines such as the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, that's a real important point to dig into.
It's crucial, particularly in the last year when we had these high-profile incidents, questions of community trust come into play and questions about police legitimacy come into play. Usually what causes the community to mistrust the police stems from some type of use of force incident. So if we have less force, then obviously college education officers engaging in less force, that's a positive finding.
I want to talk about this dissatisfaction that you found particularly strong amongst the college-educated officers. Are we seeing maybe the unhappy intersection of what they hoped they would be doing in their jobs, maybe helping society, and then smacking up against the tough realities of police work?
Our sense is that those with a college education are coming out with different level of expectations coming into the job. And they've already been through 4 years of various types of courses. They've overcome hurdles of getting all of their credits. And they're coming out with an expectation, I believe, that they want to help folks. They strongly, I know from teaching many years here at Michigan State, the students come out with a strong sense of wanting to help and particularly engage in that law enforcement role of catching the bad guy. And when they come out, they realize much of policing is not about catching the bad guy. It's actually much more social work oriented.
And then you also, your research has led you to question the seniority system, throwing new officers into the deepest end of the pool in the toughest situations. Can you talk a little more about that?
Policing is an occupation in which we take those that have the least amount of experience, those officers that come right out of the police academy, and we generally put them in the most difficult to police circumstances. So those officers usually get assigned the highest crime beats in any given city, usually occurring on the night shift over the weekend. So, you know, times when crime are high, we have often the least experienced officers being placed into that circumstance. And that's generally a function in most jurisdictions of the police union and the seniority system of how officers can bid on getting more favorable assignments. From a manager perspective, a lot of times chiefs don't have a lot of flexibility to put their more senior officers in those types of crime beats.
But that reality, if I wanted to draw out a medical analogy, that's like taking somebody who's, you know, just gotten his diploma in medical school and then sending him into the operating theater as the chief surgeon.
Exactly right. It's an expectation that's really unfair to everyone, the officer on the street and the community in which that officer is charged with policing. And we found that education and experience ultimately have the same effect. Those that are educated and those that have more experience are able to police more effectively, i.e. with less force. The difficulty is you can only get experience after you're on the job for a number of years. But if you have an agency that requires a four-year degree, you can get that benefit of experience right out of the academy.
Your research has led you to have some thoughts about the attitudes of the commanding officers and police administrators, and you found that the college-educated officers kind of tended to have negative views of their supervisors. Is there some kind of course adjustment that could be in order in departments across the country?
I'm not sure how much can be done from a policy perspective in that regard. I really think it's just simply college is increasingly becoming more of a problem-solving, analytical type of environment in which we encourage, me as a professor, I encourage my students to problem-solve and be creative and so forth. But the world of policing oftentimes is set up historically and even contemporary times, it's set up in a quasi-military structure. And so supervisors aren't looking for someone to be creative, so to speak. They're looking for someone to follow the rules, follow the policies. And I think the officers that have a college degree come out, you know, wanting a little bit more flexibility for how they go about their job. And the supervisors don't allow that. And so it creates frustration on the part of the officers.
So, Bill, what do we take away from your study? I'm still trying to decide, do cops need college to do their job well, or does it create more dissatisfaction and maybe somehow undermine what they want to do?
There certainly is dissatisfaction there in terms of the job and towards their supervisors. So I think at this point, we see that there's a beneficial effect when it comes to their behavior, and one of the most crucial behaviors an officer engages in, use of force. But if they're dissatisfied, I think that's something that has to be the realities of policing, I think that has to be worked into the equation, particularly through the police academies. What's this job going to be about? And I think the academies are still structured in a manner that plays up the law enforcer role, the arrest role, as opposed to the community role, the community policing type of role. And so I think the officers are getting mixed messages of what the expectation is going to be once they hit the street. And I think we need to do a better job as an institution of policing to say, you know, this is about social work. It's not so much about law enforcement. So you think of that term law enforcement versus policing, you'll notice that most universities, we use the term policing to signify policing's much broader than simply enforcing the law. And I think those expectations have to be made clear by police organizations themselves of what the role is.
Bill Terrell is a criminologist with Michigan State University. Bill, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.